You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. On today's programme, we'll be speaking to the man who might be the next president of Finland. We'll find out what it's like to fly in the new Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, was aboard for the long-delayed aircraft's first long-haul flight last week. We'll have some practical and learned advice about how to gain more willpower and self-control. And I'm not going to tell you exactly when, so concentrating for the full hour of the programme will be useful practice. And we'll get the latest from a Madrid food fair. All this plus more and music on tonight's instalment of Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, the latest world news with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Arab states are appealing to world powers to help end the crisis in Syria after months of failed efforts to persuade President Bashar al-Assad to halt a 10-month crackdown on his opponents. The cornerstone of their efforts, a 165-strong peace monitoring effort, was thrown into doubt today when Gulf Arab states began withdrawing 55 of their monitors, saying they had failed to stem the violence. However, Arab League chief Nabil al-Arabi and the Qatari Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim al-Thani, who heads the organization's committee on Syria, wrote to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon requesting a meeting to seek the Security Council's support for the League's faltering peace effort. The Eurozone debt crisis is escalating and could derail the global economic recovery, the International Monetary Fund warned today, as it called for urgent action to restore confidence. The IMF chopped its 2012 forecast for global growth to 3.3% from 4% just 3 months ago, saying the outlook had deteriorated in most regions. Eurozone finance ministers rejected as insufficient an offer made by private creditors to help restructure Greece's debts, sending negotiators back to the drawing board and raising anew the threat of a disorderly Greek default. However, Jean-Claude Juncker, the chairman of the Eurogroup countries, says there's never been any doubt that Greece's future lies within the Eurozone.
Let me make it crystal clear. There are absolutely no divergences of view on this matter around the table. The future of Greece is clearly within the euro area.
Four car bombs exploded in mainly Shiite Muslim areas of Baghdad today, killing 14 people and wounding 75, underlining a political crisis that threatens to revive sectarian strife in Iraq. The first blast hit a group of day labourers gathering for jobs in the poor northeastern Sadr city area of the capital. The head of Egypt's ruling military council said today he had decided to lift a state of emergency, except in certain cases. Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi said the move would come into effect from tomorrow, January the 25th, the first anniversary of the start of the protests that led to the overthrow of President Hosni Mubarak. Salvage crews have begun preparations to pump thousands of tons of fuel from the wreck of the Costa Concordia as the search continued for bodies 11 days after the giant Italian cruise liner struck a rock off the Tuscan coast and capsized. 16 bodies have been recovered so far. A French law making it illegal to deny the mass killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks a century ago will come into effect within the next fortnight. Lawmakers in the upper house of parliament voted in favour of the draft bill outlawing genocide after heated debate, prompting angry retaliation from Turkey, which threatened to cut diplomatic ties between the two countries. Analyst Cengiz Aktar says it's not just Nicolas Sarkozy that is supporting the bill.
This law is accepted not only by his party, but also by the party of his main challenger. He managed to raise the tensions very high.
Republican U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney bowed to political pressure and cracked the books on his personal finances today, releasing U.S. tax returns showing he pays a lower effective tax rate than many top wage earners. But during an NBC News debate, Romney shot back against his main rival, Newt Gingrich, over his time as Speaker in Congress.
It's shaping up to be a long and bitter battle. Florida will be the first big state to vote, and money is now pouring into these campaigns. They'll take to the debate stage yet again on Thursday.
And briefly, silent-era throwback film The Artist and Martin Scorsese, I should say, Hugo led the pack of Oscar nominees today, including nods in the Best Film category in the race for the world's top movie honours. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. And now a look at the world weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
First up, Europe and across the Mediterranean, some big contrasts in the weather this week. Sunshine and mild for most of the Spanish coast. However, in far eastern parts of the Mediterranean, a lot of cloud, rain and cold too. It'll stay like it in Greece and Cyprus all week, for example. For Western Europe, most major cities will have rain. In Scandinavia and Eastern Europe, though, cold enough for some snow. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In London, 10 degrees and cloudy. Berlin, 0 and cloudy. Moscow, minus 10 and sunny. In Palermo, 12 degrees with partly cloudy skies. How about North America? A lot of good weather to talk about Tuesday through Wednesday. Sunshine for much of the Atlantic seaboard. Good weather also for Chicago and most of the Midwest. And clear and cold midweek for Quebec and Ontario. Now, Southern California, a bit of a winter heat wave here. Here's Wednesday's city forecast. In downtown Los Angeles, 26 degrees and sunny. It'll stay like it all week and into the weekend. Chicago, 2 degrees and sunny. Toronto, plus 1 and sunny. In New York City, 6 degrees with sunny skies. So that's for Wednesday. Other world destinations, next 2 days. Middle East, in Tel Aviv, 20 degrees with sunny skies. Similar in Cairo. Abu Dhabi, 20 Celsius with lots of sunshine too. How about you might be off to Cape Town? Here, 30 degrees, also with some sunshine. And quickly on a powerful cyclone in the Mozambique Channel, the good news is no threat to land as it's staying well out to sea. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, Finland votes in the conclusive second round of their presidential election on Sunday, February the 5th. They'll be choosing between Sauli Niinisto of the National Coalition Party and Green League candidate Pekka Haavisto. Mr. Haavisto is the first Green politician to have reached the second round of Finland's presidential election. He joins us now. Mr. Haavisto, good evening.
Good evening.
Are you surprised to find yourself in the second round?
Well, of course, we had a very tough competition, actually, with the Centre Party main candidate, Paavo Väyrynen. So our difference was something like 1% in the end. And, of course, this is a new situation for a Green candidate and a very interesting situation.
Having got this far, what issues are you going to be campaigning on in the final stages of the contest?
Well, I think the issues will not change. Of course, I have been campaigning for more international Finland, more active role for Finland in the United Nations, and probably, hopefully, our coming membership on the UN Security Council should be used in a good way of keeping the Finnish tradition in peace mediation, like President Ahtisaari has been doing, also supporting the world peace through having the Finnish peacekeepers in different operations. And of course then being an active member in European Union, I'm pro-European Union, pro-Euro, even if it looks difficult at this moment to keep the currency stable. And then internally in the country, I think we have had in the last parliamentary elections a certain tendency of xenophobia, criticism against foreigners, Finland and I hope that Finland is coming back to the civilized scene on these issues.
You spoke there of the peacemaking efforts of Martti Ahtisaari, who of course won the 2008 Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. And you have experience yourself in conflict resolution in Sudan and Somalia. Why do you think it's important that Finland, of all countries, takes a role in these areas?
Well, I think that peace mediation, of course, it's also a tradition of the Nordic countries. I know that Norway, Sweden has been also doing their part on these issues. But whenever I see the Middle East and what role Europe could play there more actively, whenever I look Iran or the North Africa issues, I think there's room for negotiations, there's room for mediation in different conflicts. And of course, I've been myself being deeply involved in both Sudan issues as a representative of UN and as well as a representative of European Union, and now recently been following Somalia. And I think Finland could play its part in finding peace in these areas.
In that context, both you and your opponent are, of course, pro-EU very much. How do you personally feel about NATO membership? Is that one of the differences between you?
Well, personally, I'm critical to ideas of NATO membership. I actually don't think that would increase any way Finland's security. We have, of course, our own defense force. We are a member of European Union, where we're also deeper discussion on security issues have been ongoing, and I think we are in a stable position now.
And how do you think that Finland itself has changed during the 12 years that Tarja Halonen has been president? Do you think it's a very different country than it was all that time ago?
Well, Tarja Halonen, of course, became a symbol of equality between men and women in Finland, but also internationally a female president, and she was a very visible figure also in some of the UN organizations like ILO and so on. And I think also she gave a lot of trust to girls in Finland that they can fulfill their dreams, even one day become a president. So I think for the equality, she made an independent or very important role in Finland. Of course, we are coming a little bit to the new era. I think that when we are looking around ourselves, of course, the developments in European Union are important, but we should also look to the emerging economies, rapidly rising economies, including, of course, Russia, China, Latin America, and some of the African economies. And I have been taking this topic very much in the presidential campaign, that actually also the Finnish companies and Finnish industries, including the clean tech and environmentally sound technologies, we should be more active in these new markets.
If you did manage to win on Sunday week, is there one particular platform of the Green League's or one particular policy of the Green League's platform that you would like to enact during your presidency?
Well, of course, I have been in favor of Finland being active on climate issues and also supporting more active role of European Union. We have just had the Durban conference, which in one way was successful, that there was the agreement of negotiating new agreement after Kyoto. Of course, these issues would be important. We are also in Finland asking that why our industries and our workplaces are sometimes disappearing to these new rapidly growing economies. And then people also refer that maybe the environmental norms or the norms of the labor life are not at the same level, of course, as in European Union. So when I look at the global trade and actually the rules of the global trade, I would very much like to advocate also similar high-level environmental criteria and as well as the labor criteria in the world. And of course, these are issues where European Union can have an influence as well as WTO and UN.
And just finally and quickly, do you think you can win?
Well, of course, Mr. Niinistö had a better first round result, but now we have a lot of homeless votes and homeless parties which lost their own candidate in the first round, and of course these voters are now looking for the better option for the second round, and I think this will be a very, very equal battle between us.
Well, if you do manage to win, we hope you'll come back and talk to us when you're president. Thank you very much for your time this evening. That was Pekka Haavisto, Green League candidate for the Finnish presidency. It's now time for our first song this evening. This is James Yule with Sing Me a Song. You leave me, you leave me. That was James Yule with Sing Me a Song. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be hearing from our editor-in-chief, who is one of the few people right now who knows what it's like to fly long-haul on the new Boeing 787.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
Now, Boeing's long-delayed 787 Dreamliner finally became airborne in commercial livery last October, and last week it made its long-haul debut on an all-Nippon Airways service between Tokyo and Frankfurt. Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, was aboard the return service. He joins us in Studio One now. Tyler, what's the difference between a 787 and any other passenger aircraft you've flown on?
Well, I think one of the key things is the basic construction. This is an aircraft which, and Boeing has made a huge point about it, it's been a big collaboration, of course, between Japan Incorporated and Boeing, that this is a carbon fiber aircraft almost through and through. Now, of course, there are metal and aluminium struts and other components too, but they've made a big point that with Terai Industries and a lot of the other big carbon fiber players in Japan, you know, this is the future of aviation.
And what difference does it make to the passenger experience when you're used to flying on the sort of the great steel birds of the sky?
Well, it doesn't make a lot of difference to your ticket. They've made a lot of noise about the fact that, of course, it is a more fuel-efficient aircraft. It is a quieter aircraft. Before we took off from Frankfurt, there was probably the most sort of delightful moment for any of the speakers was the COO of the airport saying that he was very happy because there's, of course, a lot of grumpy residents and, you know, the whole German green movement is quite a boisterous and vocal one. So he said that this aircraft is 60% quieter when you hear it from the ground. Oddly, though, when you get on board, it's not that quiet.
Is it noticeably noisier than a 777 or an Airbus?
Well, they've also made much noise about the fact, and maybe too much noise about the fact that that this aircraft does not pull its cabin air in through the engines and then cools it down, which I never thought was a great idea anyway. But it has a different type of air system. It creates some kind of ambient humming noise, which I found this kind of very high-pitched whine on board. The engines, I found it probably a little bit noisier than a 777. But I guess the other thing too is that it's I felt there's a lot of electronic static on board. There was a lot of other humming and hissing, which was.
Was that a perceptible thing, or do you think you might have been more inclined to notice that just because you've heard all the hype about how it's the first carbon fiber aircraft and it's a new thing? So I think in those circumstances, you tend to listen out for what's wrong or different or a bit weird.
Well, yeah, I think also when you still feel you're something of a guinea pig on this aircraft. And, you know, of course, this aircraft has now flown, you know, hundreds, if not probably thousands of times. It's had plenty of cycles. You still sort of feel, okay, this is, not quite the maiden, but as you said, it was the return journey from Frankfurt. You're still just thinking, okay, as you're sort of hurtling down the runway. And that was the one thing you notice about a carbon fiber aircraft is there's a lot more, I mean, of course, aircraft always shake, but this was a lot more rattling. I was watching sort of the center bins and they were swaying back and forth quite a bit.
Yeah, if there is a certain kind of person who's happy about the idea of being a test pilot of some sort, but that may not be the majority of air travelers, I think. Were there any aspects of the 787 that you liked better than its rivals?
One thing, let's be clear about, you know, what this aircraft is. It has really been marketed as this point-to-point aircraft. I think a lot of people know that, you know, Airbus has one view, that it's about taking their A380s, you know, dumping people into major hubs and then getting them onto A320s, and then they can connect in and out of major hubs. Boeing has taken the view with 787 that this is, that the future is really point-to-point, and ANA is using the aircraft in that way. It's opening up very niche routes. Tokyo into San Jose, California, for example, is going to be one of the upcoming routes. So they know that they can operate these long, you know, lean, thin routes. So the aircraft which comes closest to that is a Boeing 767. And in many ways, this is a slightly dragged up version of a 767. I mean, people who think it's really going to be revolutionary when they walk on board. Yes, there's different style of lighting. It seems a little bit airier. But, you know, the other thing is are the windows. They've got these, they have... There's no more window shades on board. So you just have a button at the window, and you can adjust, you know, the window shade, you know, to complete blackout, you know, through to almost daylight. The problem is, though, it's almost like having a pair of sunglasses on the whole time, because you're always slight. I actually find that a bit disorienting, because during the day, even though it was a soupy, ugly day in Frankfurt, it was actually a little bit dimmer, you know, in the cabin than it otherwise would have been. And then when you're coming to Tokyo in the morning, it's still not that bright. And so you come off the aircraft, and so you always feel slightly cocooned. I'm always craning my neck. I want to know what's going on. I want to see the other planes close by. You know, when you're flying, you know, close to, you know, big cumulus nimbus clouds, I want to know where the lightning is. So I'm one of those people. I don't like having the window shade down. But they said the great thing is that the flight attendants can control this centrally. And I think there's sort of a sinister element to that as well.
What did other passengers seem to think about it? Because it must have been a novelty for most of the people on the flight.
Well, I was surprised, because this was, you know, while we don't do press trips here, I thought this was something which, from a sample point of view, that you know, we would get on board. So there was only maybe seven or eight journalists on the flight, only three or four people from ANA aside. I mean, let's say press people. There were other people flying the plane from ANA, but I actually felt like there wasn't that much delight on, you know, on the passenger side. There was a couple of definitely some otaku, obsessive, you know, Japanese aviation enthusiasts, you know, who went and Japanese people don't steal things. They went and took as many things off the aircraft, including the very delightful Hinoki sake cups, which they had.
So, given a choice in future, would you tend to avoid it or tend to pick it?
I'll go for a 777. I think one of the biggest problems airlines are going to have is maintenance. You see no metal on board this aircraft. The one thing I noticed when I was getting off is, so 777s, most aircraft, you know, have metal handles, which, you know, which are good for grubby fingers. By the time you got off this plane, there were just sort of smudges and marks everywhere. So I think the fuel savings that they're going to have from, of course, a lighter aircraft, I think there's going to be a lot of wear and tear. They're going to replace a lot of elements.
Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor-in-chief, thank you very much. It's time for another song. This is the almost eerily appropriate Empire of the Sun with We Are the People. That was Empire of the Sun with We Are the People. Now, if you're one of those people who checks their email every 5 minutes and then wonders why they didn't get anything done today, and one of them is sitting not far from this microphone, you definitely want to stick around for the next half an hour. But first, here's the world news.
Thanks, Andrew. Arab states are appealing to world powers to help end the crisis in Syria after months of failed efforts to persuade President Bashar al-Assad to halt a 10-month crackdown on his opponents. The Eurozone debt crisis is escalating and could derail the global economic recovery, the International Monetary Fund warned today, as it called for urgent action to restore confidence. Four car bombs exploded in mainly Shiite Muslim areas of Baghdad today, killing 14 people, wounding 75, underlining a political crisis that threatens to revive sectarian strife in Iraq. On the eve of the first anniversary of the start of the protests that led to the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, the head of Egypt's ruling military council said today he had decided to lift a state of emergency, except in certain cases. Salvage crews have begun preparations to pump thousands of tons of fuel from the wreck of the Costa Concordia as the search continued for bodies 11 days after the giant Italian cruise liner capsized. A French law making it illegal to deny the mass killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks a century ago will come into effect within the next fortnight. Republican US presidential candidate Mitt Romney bowed to political pressure and cracked the books on his personal finances today, releasing US tax returns showing he pays a lower effective tax rate than many top wage earners. And silent-era throwback film The Artist and Martin Scorsese's Hugo led the pack of Oscar nominees today, including nods in the Best Film category in the race for the world's top movie honours. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Now, Monocle magazine reached a poised half century with its 50th edition out this week. We're now joined by Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, to talk us through his section. What do we have this month, Jonathan?
Well, I have, so I've got a shiny copy of issue 50 in front of me. And so the business section kicks off with our lead report on Santos in Brazil. And the city is quite unkindly described to me as the Blackpool of Brazil. So it's this kind of, it has a vibe of a very faded seaside town. But recently there's been a discovery of an oil field that might contain anything from between 30 to 100 billion barrels in the Santos Basin. So it's become a real heart of development for not only Petrobras, but the state government, and a lot of movement there. So we lead with a report on that. We have a fair play, which is where we look at an interesting trade fair around the world. And this one was the New York Chocolate Show. So that was quite a tough gig for our correspondent.
I think we are due a round of applause for the headline "Choc Tactics."
I know Louise did well
of that one. That is inspired.
Could be chocks away.
It's hard to know where to stop, really.
And so I think David was working through a fridge full of chocolate for a while after that. And then we've got a good How I Manage as well, where we profile Christian Stadel, who's the CEO of Hummel Sports Brand in Copenhagen, and he runs his brand along Buddhist principles. So that was interesting to look at as well.
He makes Buddhist sportswear.
Well, he runs a sportswear brand, but he also writes kind of self-help books and management guides that show how to kind of, that are themed around corporate karma, essentially. So I hear that he is actually quite a hard-ass CEO as well. So I don't know how it exactly works with the Buddhist principle the whole time, but he's an interesting guy, definitely.
He's kind of like a Buddhist head kicker. He sort of smiles, but he asks you just to be accepting when he fires you.
Maybe he says an om afterwards or something. Yeah. But I think, I mean, the piece that I really wanted to highlight today was a piece that we have from our correspondent in Tehran, which is looking at the Persian rug industry, which isn't one that people think about necessarily, I think. I mean, it seems a bit like a dusty old industry, but it actually employs 2 million people in the country. And this is a country where official unemployment statistics are 23%, probably far, far higher.
It's a huge deal across Central Asia, of course. In fact, there's a very good book, if people are really interested in the subject, by an Australian journalist called Christopher Kremer, called The Carpet Wars, about Central Asian carpets, especially Afghan and Iranian carpets. But yes, it is an absolutely enormous industry.
Yeah. So I thought that we'd get our correspondent in Tehran on the phone now. So Jason, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I wanted to just start off with, can you give us a bit of background to how this story came about and just kind of set up the story for us?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I've been based here in Tehran for the past 2.5 years, and about 3 months ago, we got an interesting invitation from the ministry that handles foreign press, which was an invitation to visit the rug-producing centers of Iran. And I had grown up in Persian rug family. My father was one of the first rug dealers in San Francisco, California. So I thought this was a really good opportunity. I knew a lot about the industry from the sales point of view, but not much from the production. And I went on this trip and thought to myself, well, here's a great story. It was an incredible trip, especially because along with myself, one of the other journalists happened to grow up as a weaver. So I don't think the press ministry knew that they would have somebody on the retail end and the weaving end joining the trip and asking really intricate questions. I think it made for a good trip.
Jason, there's a lot of stereotypes associated with the carpet industry, especially from anybody who's ever visited the Middle East as a tourist. It does usually involve at some point being locked in a rug shop and told a lot of fabulous lies about the produce. What might people whose only experience of the Central Asian rug trade is that be missing?
Could you repeat the last part of the question?
What are you not seeing about the rug trade if that's your only experience of it?
Well, I think that the production of the rug is really the real magic of it. You know, beginning with the designs that they create, oftentimes from their own imagination, and that's a process that's become more mechanized with computers recently. But then the weaving, I mean, this is just one of the most painstaking art forms in the world, and it can take 2 to 3 years to produce a high-quality rug. So now that I've seen that at work, even I, who grew up in a rug shop, I have a much more astute appreciation for the craft.
And Jason, it's obviously an industry under some pressures, not only from other rug producing markets such as China, but also from specific embargoes from the likes of the US. And the most recent one was from the Obama administration in 2010. Can you tell us a bit more about this embargo and why Persian rugs have become such a target?
Well, as you mentioned in the lead up, this is an industry that employs at least 2 million Iranians. And in speaking with people on all levels of the trade here in Iran, they were saying to me, what does this have to do with politics? Why are you sanctioning us? I mean, and it's true, this is not an industry that's controlled by the Revolutionary Guard or anything like that. So it really feels as though this policy is trying to further undercut the Iranian economy and make people's lives more difficult.
Jason in Tehran and Jonathan in London, thank you both very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 38 minutes past the hour. This is Heaven 17. That was Heaven 17 with Temptation. On that subject, we'll shortly be talking to an American psychologist who has written a new book on how to avoid it, which will be bad news for Heaven 17, but might help you to get more work done. This is Monocle 24.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, everyone listening to this will at some point today have done something that wasn't good for them and which they might not even have wanted to do. And everyone listening to this has probably wondered why they do this. Professor Roy F. Baumeister of Florida State University has written a book about this vexatious tendency. Willpower, Rediscovering Our Greatest Strength, argues that the human will is like a muscle which needs flexing, strengthening, feeding, and resting. I spoke to Dr. Baumeister earlier today and asked him to talk me through some exercises.
Well, the first thing in terms of it being like a muscle is that after you use it, it gets tired. So when people have to do two self-control tasks in a row, or if there are two challenges in the course of your day, then you're less likely to succeed at the second one. In fact, we find in this study where people wore beepers and we tracked them across the course of the day, the more they resisted one desire after another, the less likely they were to succeed at resisting subsequent ones. Like a muscle getting worn out over the course of the day becomes less effective. It also is like a muscle in that if you exercise it regularly over a long period of time, it will get stronger. So that's really a very positive and promising thing in terms of enabling people to improve their willpower, improve their self-control.
So we do talk about resisting temptation as if it's a struggle. It's and a struggle on which the entire Judeo-Christian mindset is based, in fact, starting with that business with the snake and the apple. But what is the reason why temptation exists? Why is there why have we been endowed with this tendency towards being distracted if it's not good for us?
Motivation and desire begins with the necessities of life. We want things that are basically good for us, at least in the short run. And all creatures want the things that help them. It's a bit of an accident of history. We especially desire foods that are sweet and that are fatty because in evolutionary past, those were in short supply. As I said, it's a bit of an accident of history that now those are in abundance, and so the problem is too much, but it's too much of a good thing. The need to restrain our desires, and desires are natural in that they help us want things that mostly in some respects have been good for us, but the need to restrain our desires serves two very important goals. One is so that we can do things that are better in the long run, if not in the short run. And that's unique to humans. Most other animals live in the immediate present. One scholarly review of the scientific literature concluded that even the smartest animals can think maybe 15 or 20 minutes ahead into the future, and that's it. Whereas we can think years, decades, even sometimes generations into the future. And long-term goals sometimes conflict with short-term ones. So you do want to spend that money on a lovely meal, a fun-filled weekend, or save it for your retirement. Well, the natural thing, like all other animals, is to do what's good right now. But in human culture, you do have to save for retirement, or at least you'll be better off in the long run if you do. So the first one, the first thing, too, is saving resisting immediate temptations to do what's good in the future. The other is living in culture. We have to restrain our appetites so we can live together.
That's an interesting idea, that resisting temptation has become harder for human beings because now there's more of it, especially in the modern developed world. You live in a world of options which would have seemed unimaginable even 20 or 30 years ago. Do you think it's just that human psychology hasn't kept up with the advances in our environment in that respect?
It's absolutely true, yes. The human psychology changes in a very slow pace. Certainly the biological basis for it changes in a pace of tens of thousands of years. Genetic change is very slow. Culture goes quite fast. And as you say, 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't even face the bewildering array of choices that we face now. And if you go back two centuries, the idea of eating too much was a concern of a very small segment of the population. For most people, it was a matter of conserving food and trying to get enough to eat all the time. I'm told there are still cultures in the world where the idea that you dislike food is still considered bizarre, that food is so rare that if you say, oh, no, I don't like this, I don't want it, the people would laugh and then eat it themselves. Yes, the pace of cultural change has been rapid. The spread of appetizing, advertising. The spread of advertising is another factor that encourages us to want and consume a lot of things. The ready availability of so many goods. I was just strolling through London and seeing kilometer after kilometer of shops of things to buy. All of these tempting, and you need to resist those temptations. That to some extent, that's quite new.
How does one practically go about doing that? Because I think probably pretty much everybody listening to this certainly does at least one thing that they wish they didn't do, really, whether they smoke or they gamble or buy things they don't really need or fail to concentrate on what they're supposed to be working on. What are practical steps you can take?
Okay, well, the first thing is to understand how willpower works. Understand that you have a limited supply of it, that it's not a character trait, but rather a fluctuating quantity inside you. Understand what's tied into it. I think many people can understand that self-control takes energy. But some people think, well, I have good self-control for this and bad self-control for that. That's not really right. You have the same amount of willpower. You allocate it to one thing, then you don't have it for something else. But you need to manage this as a limited resource. What people don't know also is that other things like decision-making will use it. So after you make a series of choices, your willpower will be depleted and you'll be less likely to be able to successfully resist temptation, whether it's the cigarette or the potato crisps or whatever. And two, it's tied into the body's energy supply. So at times when there are other physical demands on you, I've learned, this is not my own work, but fascinated to read in other people's work about the immune system. When it's fighting off a cold, it uses a tremendous amount of the very same energy that goes into willpower. So sometimes people notice that when you start to get sick, things will bother you more. You can't control your feelings and your reactions, or maybe you make bad decisions. Well, yes, there's an excellent reason for that, is that the energy you need for those things is being preemptively used by your body to fight its illness.
So how much of your ability to exercise your willpower productively is determined by factors like basic things like sleeping and eating?
That's a significant contributor. I can't give you a numerical answer on how much, but it's a significant part. The word determined is one that I'm reluctant to embrace. In psychology, most things are probabilistic, are changes in the odds. It's not that if you didn't have a good breakfast, you are doomed to do stupid things all day. But the odds of you making all smart choices and having good self-control will be reduced if you don't eat a proper breakfast. There are nice controlled studies that look at school children where they say nobody eats breakfast and they come to school and by random assignment half of them are given breakfast and half of them are not. The ones who got breakfast, they learn better and they behave better. Now, it's not 100%, but on average, there's a difference between the groups.
That was Professor Roy F. Baumeister, author of Willpower, almost certainly a more useful book than one I once saw. And this is true. This really happened. It was called Overcoming Attention Deficit Disorder, and it was 600 pages long. You're listening to Monocle 24. Monocle's Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, is in Madrid today performing the selfless sacrifice of attending the Madrid Fusion Food Fair. Earlier this afternoon, he kindly took some time off from sampling bark-flavoured ice cream, Luna-picked wine and mountain-farmed caviar to talk to me.
It's a great environment to be in Madrid Fusion, which is the most important gastronomy food fair here in Madrid.
And which of Madrid Fusion's events or venues are you attending tonight?
Tonight I was thinking about going to Diverso. Diverso is like the hottest restaurant right now. But I'm thinking about it because they serve molecular food, and I'm not a fan of foams and infusions and jellied meat. But if I have the chance, I might go and try one of the menus.
When you say it's the hottest restaurant in Madrid, who are the people who are queuing to get into it at the moment?
Everyone at the Madrid Fusion is queuing for this restaurant, and I guess there's a lot of tourists, and also the locals are very interested in going to this restaurant. It's claimed to be the best restaurant right now in the city, so they're only taking reservations with 30 days in advance.
Wow.
That doesn't guarantee a reservation anyway.
That's a restaurant that's sure of itself if they won't even guarantee you if you book a month ahead. What's been your favorite of the venues you've visited so far?
Well, here in the fair, there isn't just one restaurant. There are many different stands with many different products. People from all over the country and overseas as well are offering their products. South Korea is the special guest, so there's a lot of kimchi. The vegetable, cured vegetables, broth that they make in South Korea. But some of the things that I've tasted that are very interesting are caviar from the Pyrenees or morcilla chips. These are like black pudding chips. And also the Wagyu beef tartare that is now made in Salamanca.
When you say caviar from the Pyrenees, it seems somewhat counterintuitive that caviar would come from a mountain range.
Yes, it's in fact quite strange. It's almost a juxtaposition. But what they do is they buy the fish from Russia, and then they breed them in some controlled pools in the Pyrenees. But it's very good caviar.
One would hope so after going to all that trouble. On the subject of curious juxtapositions, is it also the case I've been reading that there's a chef in Cadiz who is making ice cream from tree barks and pine cones?
Yes, exactly. Well, I attended a conference by Angel León. He's a chef at the Aponiente restaurant in Cadiz. And he's known as the chef of the sea for his passion working with seafood. Right now, he's growing plankton in a lab in his restaurant, and he's also been able to make fish chorizo. And he likes to incorporate a lot of mountain flavors into his food. So what he does is he marinates fish with products only found in the food or inland, for example, pigeon innards.
I'm a bit intrigued, at least I hope he's not making the ice cream with fish. I'm not sure. I think that might be a juxtaposition too far. I am intrigued about the tree barks and pine cone ice cream, though. How does that actually work? And more to the point, how does it actually taste?
Well, there's a lot of chemistry involved in that. I think what's important about this event is that chefs are no longer cooks. The idea that anyone who steps into a kitchen can already be called a chef is no longer. These people are involved in deep scientific research and analysis, and through that is that they manage to create new characteristics in food, new flavors, new shapes, new forms.
And of these new flavors, has there been one in particular that you've tried that you think has been worth the effort?
Well, as I said, the morcilla chips are probably the most interesting thing I've tried today. These are dehydrated black puddings and then shredded into chips and covered with salt, perfect for any Spanish lunchbox.
Are they also taking that same scientific method, I guess, when looking into the development of wines?
Yes, definitely. Organic wine is very popular. I just attended a 12 wine tasting, which explains why I am being so chatty right now. So biodynamic wines is like the latest trend. These are wines that are grown with no chemical or artificial additives. And a big influence right now in the market is lunar wines that are made with grapes that are picked according to lunar cycles or the moon cycles.
That was Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi reporting from Madrid. It's 1856 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that's it for tonight's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. Thank you all. In 3 hours, it is time for the Monocle Daily, our late-night news programme. That's at 2200 London time. And in just a few minutes, the premiere of the latest edition of Section D, our weekly programme on design. The headlines are coming up next on Monocle 24, and to take us out with a song, it's Laura Gibson with Le Grand.
When the moon carves a trail.